Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, and we always post links at pyville.net and also at kirksvilletoday.com. Today we're going to resume with Saki and do four more stories. We'll begin with The Dreamer. It was the season of sales. The Dreamer. The august establishment of Walpurgis and Nettlepink had lowered its prices for an entire week as a concession to trade observances, much as an archduchess might protestingly contract an attack of influenza for the unsatisfactory reason that influenza was locally prevalent. Adela Chemping, who considered herself in some measure superior to the allurements of an ordinary bargain sale, made a point of attending the reduction week at Walpurgis and Nettlepink's. "I'm not a bargain hunter," she said, "but I like to go where the bargains are." Which showed that beneath her surface of strength of character, there flowed a gracious undercurrent of human weakness. With a view to providing herself with a male escort, Mrs. Chemping had invited her youngest nephew to accompany her on the first day of the shopping expedition, throwing in the additional allurement of a cinematograph theater and the prospect of light refreshment. Some proto-movies or movies. As Cyprian was not yet 18, she hoped he might not have reached that stage in masculine development when parcel carrying is looked on as a thing abhorrent. "Meet me just outside the floral department," she wrote to him, "and don't be a moment later than 11. Cyprian was a boy who carried with him through early life the wondering look of a dreamer, the eyes of one who sees things that are not visible to ordinary mortals, and invests the commonplace things of this world with qualities unsuspected by plainer folk, the eyes of a poet or a house agent. He was quietly dressed, that sartorial quietude which frequently accompanies early adolescence, and is usually attributed by novel writers to the influence of a widowed mother. His hair was brushed back in a smoothness as of ribbon seaweed and seamed with a narrow furrow that scarcely aimed at being a parting. His aunt particularly noted this item of his toilet when they met at the appointed rendezvous, because he was standing waiting for her bareheaded. "Where's your hat?" she asked. "I didn't bring one with me," he replied. Adela Chemping was slightly scandalized. "You are not going to be what they call a nut, are you?" capital N, she inquired with some anxiety, partly with the idea that a nut would be an extravagance which her sister's small household would scarcely be justified in incurring, partly perhaps with the instinctive apprehension that a nut, even in its embryo stage, would refuse to carry parcels. Cyprian looked at her with his wondering, dreamy eyes. "I didn't bring a hat," he said, "because it is such a nuisance when one is shopping. I mean, it is so awkward if one meets anyone one knows and has to take one's hat off when one's hands are full of parcels. If one hasn't got a hat on, one can't take it off." Mrs. Chemping sighed with great relief. Her worst fear had been laid to rest. "It is more orthodox to wear a hat," she observed, and then turned her attention briskly to the business in hand. "We will go first to the table and encounter," she said, leading the way in that direction. "I should like to look at some napkins." The wondering look deepened in Cyprian's eyes as he followed his aunt. He belonged to a generation that is supposed to be overfond of the role of mere spectator, but looking at napkins that one did not mean to buy was a pleasure beyond his comprehension. Mrs. Chemping held one or two napkins up to the light and stared fixedly at them, as though she half expected to find some revolutionary cipher written on them in scarcely visible ink. Then she suddenly broke away in the direction of the glassware department. "Millicent asked me to get her a couple of decanters if they were going to be really cheap," she explained on the way, "and I really do want a salad bowl. I can come back to the napkins later on." She handled and scrutinized a large number of decanters and a long series of salad bowls and finally bought 7 chrysanthemum vases. No one uses that kind of vase nowadays, she informed Cyprian, but they will do for presents next Christmas. Again, he's commenting on the manners of women and how irrational and vicious they can be. Money hungry. Two sunshades that were marked down to a price that Mrs. Chemping considered absurdly cheap were added to her purchases. One of them will do for Ruth Coulson. She is going out to the Malay States, and a sunshade will always be useful there. And I must get her some thin writing paper. It takes up no room in one's baggage. Mrs. Chemping bought stacks of writing paper. It was so cheap, and it went so flat in the trunk or portmanteau. She also bought a few envelopes. Envelopes somehow seemed rather an extravagance compared with note paper. Do you think Ruth will like blue or gray paper? She asked Cyprian. Gray, said Cyprian, who had never met the lady in question. Have you any mauve newspaper? Have you any mauve note paper of this quality? Adela asked the assistant. We haven't any mauve, said the assistant, but we've got two shades of green and a darker shade of gray. Mrs. Chemping inspected the greens and the darker gray and chose the blue. Now we can have some lunch, she said. Cyprian behaved in an exemplary fashion in the refreshment department and cheerfully accepted a fish cake and a mince pie and a small cup of coffee as adequate restoratives after 2 hours of concentrated shopping. He was adamant, however, in resisting his aunt's suggestion that a hat should be bought for him at the counter where men's headwear was being disposed of at temptingly reduced prices. I've got as many hats as I want at home, he said, and besides, it rumples one's hair so, trying them on. Perhaps he was going to develop into a nut, after all. It was a disquieting symptom that he left all the parcels in charge of the cloakroom attendant. We shall be getting more parcels presently, he said, so we need not collect these till we have finished our shopping. His aunt was doubtfully appeased. Some of the pleasure and excitement of a shopping expedition seemed to evaporate when one was deprived of immediate personal contact with one's purchases. I'm going to look at those napkins again, she said, as they descended to the stairs to the ground floor. You need not come, she added, as the dreaming look in the boy's eyes changed for a moment into one of mute protest. You can meet me afterwards in the cutlery department. I've just remembered that I haven't a corkscrew in the house that can be depended on. Cyprian was not to be found in the cutlery department when his aunt in due course arrived there, but in the crush and bustle of anxious shoppers and busy attendants, it was an easy matter to miss anyone. It was in the leather goods department of some quarter of an hour later that Adela Chemping caught sight of her nephew, separated from her by a rampart of suitcases and portmanteau and hemmed in by the jostling crush of human beings that now invaded every corner of the great shopping emporium. She was just in time to witness a pardonable but rather embarrassing mistake on the part of a lady who had wriggled her way with unstable determination towards the bareheaded Cyprian and was now breathlessly demanding the sale price of a handbag which had taken her fancy. "There now," exclaimed Adela to herself. "She takes him for one of the shop assistants because he hasn't got a hat on. I wonder it hadn't happened before." Perhaps it had. Cyprian, at any rate, seemed neither startled nor embarrassed by the error into which the good lady had fallen. Examining the ticket on the bag, he announced in a clear, dispassionate voice, "Black seal, 34 shillings, marked down to 28. As a matter of fact, we are clearing them out at a special reduction price of 26 shillings. They are going off rather fast." "I'll take it," said the lady, eagerly digging some coins out of her purse. "Will you take it as is?" asked Cyprian. "It will be a matter of a few minutes to get it wrapped up. There is such a crush." "Never mind, I'll take it as it is," said the purchaser, clutching her treasure and counting the money into Cyprian's palm. Several kind strangers helped Adela into the open air. "It's the crush and the heat," said one sympathizer to another. "It's enough to turn anyone giddy." When she next came across Cyprian, he was standing in the crowd that pushed and jostled around the counters of the book department. The dream look was deeper than ever in his eyes. He had just sold 2 books of devotion to an elderly canon. That's like a preacher type. So Cyprian may have had to go shopping, but he turned it to his advantage. Rather in a way that was the other C would have done, Clovis. And I don't know why he was named Cyprian instead of Clovis. Next story, the quince tree. I've just been to see old Betsy Mullen, announced Vera to her aunt, Mrs. Beverly Crumble. She seems rather in a bad way about her rent. She owes about 15 weeks of it, and she says she doesn't know where any of it is to come from. Betsy Mullen is always in difficulties with her rent, and the more people help her with it, the less she troubles about it, said the aunt. I certainly am not going to assist her anymore. The fact is, she will have to go into a smaller and cheaper cottage. There are several to be had at the other end of the village for half the rent she is paying, or is supposed to be paying now. I told her a year ago that she ought to move. But she wouldn't get such a nice garden anywhere else, protested Vera, and there's such a jolly quince tree in the corner. I don't suppose there's another quince tree in the whole parish. And she never makes any quince jam. I think to have a quince tree and not to make quince jam shows such strength of character. No, she can't possibly move away from that garden. When one is 16, said Mrs. Beverly Crumble severely, one talks of things being impossible, which are merely uncongenial. It is not only possible, but it is desirable that Betsy Mullen should move into smaller quarters. She has scarcely enough furniture to fill that big cottage. As far as value goes, said Vera after a short pause, there is more in Betsy's cottage than in any other house for miles around. Nonsense, said the aunt. She parted with whatever old chinaware she had long ago. I'm not talking about anything that belongs to Betsy herself, said Vera darkly. But of course you don't know what I know, and I don't suppose I ought to tell you. You must tell me at once, exclaimed the aunt, her senses leaping into alertness like those of a terrier, suddenly exchanging a bored drowsiness for the lively anticipation of an immediate rat hunt. I'm perfectly certain that I oughtn't to tell you anything about it, said Vera, but then I often do things that I oughtn't to do. I should be the last person to suggest that you should do anything that you ought not to do, began Mrs. Beverly Crumble impressively. And I am always swayed by the last person who speaks to me, admitted Vera, so I'll do what I ought not to do and tell you. Mrs. Beverly Crumble thrust a very pardonable sense of exasperation into the background of her mind and demanded impatiently, What is there in Betsy Mullen's cottage that you are making such a fuss about? It's hardly fair to say that I've made a fuss about it, said Vera. This is the first time I've mentioned the matter. But there's been no end of trouble and mystery and newspaper speculation about it. It's been rather amusing to think of the columns of conjecture in the press and the police and detectives hunting about everywhere at home and abroad, and all the while that innocent-looking little cottage has held the secret. You don't mean to say it's the Louvre picture, La something or other, the woman with a smile that disappeared about 2 years ago, exclaimed the aunt with rising excitement. Oh, no, not that, said Vera, but something quite as important and just as mysterious, if anything, rather more scandalous. Not the Dublin, Vera nodded. The whole jolly lot of them? In Betsy's cottage? Incredible. Of course, Betsy hasn't any idea as to what they are, said Vera. She just knows that they are something valuable and that she must keep quiet about them. I found out quite by accident what they were and how they came to be there. You see, people who had them were at their wits' end and nowhere to stow them away for safekeeping, and someone who was motoring through the village was struck by the snug loneliness of the cottage and thought it would be just the thing. Mrs. Lamper arranged the matter with Betsy and smuggled the things in. Mrs. Lamper? Yes, she does a lot of district visiting, you know. I'm quite aware that she takes soup and flannel and improving literature to the poorer cottages, said Mrs. Beverly Crumble. But that is hardly the same sort of thing as disposing of stolen goods, and she must have known something about their history. Anyone who reads the papers, even casually, must have been aware of the theft, and I should think the things were not hard to recognize. Mrs. Lamper has always had the reputation of being a very conscientious woman. Of course, she was screening someone else, said Vera. A remarkable feature of the affair is the extraordinary number of quite respectable people who have involved themselves in its meshes by trying to shield others. You would be really astonished if you knew some of the names of the individuals mixed up in it, and I don't suppose a tithe of them, that is a tenth, tithing in a church tenth, who the original culprits were, and now I've got you entangled in the mess by letting you into the secret of the cottage. You most certainly have not entangled me, said Mrs. Beverly Crumble, or Cumble. I've been misstating it. Cumble, C-U-M-B-L-E. I have no intention of shielding anybody. The police must know about it at once. A theft is a theft, whoever is involved. If respectable people choose to turn themselves into receivers and disposers of stolen goods, well, they've ceased to be respectable. That's all. I shall telephone immediately. Oh, Aunt, said very reproachfully, it would break the poor canon's heart if Cuthbert were to be involved in a scandal of this sort. You know it would. Cuthbert involved? How can you say such things when you know how much we all think of him? Of course I know you think a lot of him, and that he's engaged to marry Beatrice, and that it will be a frightfully good match, and that he's your ideal of what a son-in-law ought to be. All the same, it was Cuthbert's idea to store the things away in the cottage, and it was his motor that brought them. He was only doing it to help his friend, Pegginson, you know, the Quaker man, who is always agitating for a smaller navy. I forget how he got involved in it. I warned you that there were lots of quite respectable people mixed up in it, didn't I? That's what I meant when I said it would be impossible for old Betsy to leave the cottage. The things take up a good bit of room, and she couldn't go carrying them about with her other goods and chattels without attracting notice. Of course, if she were to fall ill and die, it would be equally unfortunate. Her mother lived to be over 90, she tells me, so with due care and an absence of worry, she ought to last for another dozen years, at least. By that time, perhaps some other arrangements will have been made for disposing of the wretched things. I shall speak to Cuthbert about it after the wedding, said Mrs. Beverly Cumble. The wedding is until next year, said Vera, in recounting the story to her best girlfriend, and meanwhile old Betsy is living rent-free with soup twice a week and my aunt's doctor to see her whenever she has a finger ache. But how on earth did you get to know about it all? Asked her friend in admiring wonder. It was a mystery, said Vera. Of course it was a mystery that baffled everybody. What beats me is how you found out. Oh, about the jewels? I invented that part, explained Vera. I mean, the mystery was where old Betsy's arrears of rent were to come from, and she would have hated leaving that jolly quince tree. So we see yet again that Vera really is the female version of Cyprian, or more so Clovis. The Forbidden Buzzards Is matchmaking at all in your line? Hugo Peterby asked the question with a certain amount of personal interest. I don't specialize in it, said Clovis. It's all right when you're doing it, but the after effects are sometimes so disconcerting. The mute, reproachful looks of the people you've aided and abetted in matrimonial experiments. It's as bad as selling a man a horse with a half dozen latent vices and watching them discover them piecemeal in the course of the hunting season. I suppose you're thinking of the Colterneb girl. She's certainly jolly and quite all right as far as looks go, and I believe a certain amount of money adheres to her. What I don't see is how you will ever manage to propose to her. In all the time I've known her, I don't remember her to have stopped talking for 3 consecutive minutes. You'll have to race her 6 times around the grass paddock for a bet, and then blurt your proposal out before she's got her wind back. The paddock is laid up for hay, but if you're really in love with her, you won't let a consideration of that sort stop you, especially as it's not your hay. I think I could manage the proposing part right enough, said Hugo, if I could count on being left alone with her for 4 or 5 hours. The trouble is that I'm not likely to get anything like that amount of grace. That fellow Lanner is showing signs of interesting himself in the same quarter. He's quite heartbreakingly rich and is rather a swell in his own way. In fact, our hostess is obviously a bit flattered at having him here. If she gets wind of the fact he's inclined to be attracted by Betty Colterneb, she'll think it a splendid match and throw them into each other's arms all day long, and then where will my opportunities come in? My one anxiety is to keep him out of the girl's way as much as possible, and if you could help me... If you want me to trot Lanner around the countryside, inspecting alleged Roman remains and studying local methods of bee culture and crop raising, I'm afraid I can't oblige you, said Clovis. You see, he's taken something like an aversion to me since the other night in the smoking room. What happened in the smoking room? He trotted out some well-worn chestnut as the latest thing in good stories, and I remarked, quite innocently, that I never could remember whether it was George II or James II who was so fond of that particular story, and now he regards me with politely draped dislike. I'll do my best for you if the opportunity arises, but it will have to be in a roundabout, impersonal manner. It's so nice having Mr. Lanner here, confided Mrs. Olson to Clovis the next afternoon. He's always been engaged when I've asked him before. Such a nice man. He really ought to have married some nice girl. Between you and me, I have an idea that he came down here for a certain reason. I've had much the same idea, said Clovis, lowering his face. In fact, I'm almost certain of it. You mean he's attracted by, began Mrs. Olson eagerly. I mean he's here for what he can get, said Clovis. For what he can get, said the hostess, with a touch of indignation in her voice. What do you mean? He's a very rich man. Why should he want to get here? What should he want to get here? He has one ruling passion, said Clovis, and there's something he can get here that is not to be had for love, nor money, nor anywhere else in the country, as far as I know. But what? Whatever do you mean? What is his ruling passion? Something the Jesuits always sought to seek out to manipulate a man, if you remember our E. Michael Jones audio sessions. If you know a man's ruling passion, you will know how to manipulate him. What do you mean? What is his ruling passion? Egg collecting, said Clovis. He has agents all over the world getting rare eggs for him, and his collection is one of the finest in Europe. But his great ambition is to collect his treasures personally. He stops at no expense nor trouble to achieve that end. Good heavens, the buzzards, the rough-legged buzzards, exclaimed Mrs. Olson. You don't think he's going to raid their nest? What do you think yourself? Asked Clovis. The only pair of rough-legged buzzards known to breed in this country are nesting in your woods. Very few people know about them. But as a member of the League for Protecting Rare Birds, that information would be at his disposal. I came down in the train with him, and I noticed that a bulky volume of Dresser's Birds of Europe was one of the requisites that he had packed in his traveling kit. It was the volume dealing with short-winged hawks and buzzards. Clovis believed that if a lie is worth telling, it was worth telling well. This is appalling, said Miss Olson. My husband would never forgive me if anything happened to those birds. They've been seen about the woods for the last year or two, but this is the first time they've nested. As you say, they are almost the only pair known to be breeding in the whole of Great Britain. And now their nest is going to be harried by a guest staying under my roof? I must do something to stop it. Do you think if I appealed to him? Clovis laughed. There's a story going about, which I fancy is true in most of its details, of something that happened not long ago somewhere on the coast of the Sea of Marmora, in which our friend had a hand. A Syrian nightjar, or some such bird, was known to be breeding in the olive gardens of a rich Armenian who, for some reason or other, wouldn't allow Ladder to go in and take the eggs, though he offered cash down for the permission. The Armenian was found beaten near to death a day or two later and his fences leveled. It was assumed to be a case of a Muslim aggression, word for Muslims, and noted as such in all the consular reports, but the eggs are in the Lanner collection. No, I don't think I should appeal to his better feelings if I were you. I must do something, said Mrs. Olson tearfully. My husband's parting words when he went off to Norway were an injunction to see that those birds were not disturbed, and he's asked about them every time he's written. Do suggest something. I was going to suggest picketing, said Clovis. Picketing? You mean setting guards round the birds? No, round Lanner. He can't find his way through those woods by night, and you could arrange that you or Evelyn or Jack or the German governess should be by his side in relays all day long. A fellow guest you could get rid of, but he couldn't very well shake off members of the household, and even the most determined collector would hardly go climbing after forbidden buzzard's eggs with a German governess hanging around his neck, so to speak. Lanner, who had been lazily watching for an opportunity for prosecuting his courtship of the Coulterneb girl, found presently that his chances of getting her to himself for 10 minutes, even, were non-existent. If the girl was ever alone, he never was. His hostess had changed suddenly, as far as he was concerned, from the desirable type that lets her guests do nothing in the way that best pleases them, to the sort that drags them over the ground like so many harrows. She showed him the herb garden and the greenhouses, the village church, some watercolor sketches that her sister had done in Corsica, and the place where it was hoped that the celery would grow later in the year. He was shown all the Aylesbury ducklings and the row of wooden hives where there would have been bees if there had not been bee disease. So that was a thing even back then. He was also taken to the end of a long lane and shown a distant mound whereon local tradition reported that the Danes had once pitched a camp. And when his hostess had to desert him temporarily for other duties, he would find Evelyn walking solemnly by his side. Evelyn was 14 and talked chiefly about good and evil, and how much one might accomplish in the way of regenerating the world if one was thoroughly determined to do one's utmost. It was generally rather a relief when she was displaced by Jack, who was 9 years old, and talked exclusively about the Balkan War without throwing any fresh light on its political or military history. The German governess told Lanner more about Schiller than he had ever heard in his life about any one person. It was perhaps his own fault for having told her that he was not interested in Goethe. When the governess went off picket duty, the hostess was again on hand with a not-to-be-gainsaid invitation to visit the cottage of an old woman who remembered Charles James Fox. The woman had been dead for 2 or 3 years, but the cottage was still there. Lanner was called back to town earlier than he had originally intended. Hugo did not bring off his affair with Betty Coulterneb. Whether she refused him, as was more generally supposed, he did not get a chance of saying 3 consecutive words. Has never been exactly ascertained. Anyhow, she is still the jolly Coulterneb girl. The Buzzard successfully reared 2 young ones, which were shot by a local hairdresser. Nice little final touch. And finally, the last story for today, the steak. "Ronnie is a great child to me," said Mrs. Attray, Attray, plaintively. "Ronnie is a great trial to me," said Mrs. Attray, plaintively. "Only 18 years old last February and already a confirmed gambler. I am sure I don't know where he inherits it from. His father never touched cards, and you know how little I play, a game of bridge on Wednesday afternoons in the winter, for 3 pence a hundred, and even that I shouldn't do if it wasn't that Edith always wants a 4th, and would be certain to ask that detestable Jenkinham woman if she couldn't get me. I would much rather sit and talk any day than play bridge. Cards are such a waste of time, I think. But as to Ronnie, bridge and baccarat and poker patience are positively all that he thinks about. Of course, I've done my best to stop it. I've asked the Nordrums not to let him play cards when he's over there, but you might as well ask the Atlantic Ocean to keep quiet for a crossing as expect them to bother about a mother's natural anxieties." "Why do you let him go there?" asked Eleanor Saxelby. "My dear," said Mrs. Attray, "I don't want to offend them. After all, they are my landlords, and I have to look to them for anything I want done about the place. They were very accommodating about the new roof for the orchard house, and they lend me one of their cars when mine is out of order. You know how often it gets out of order." "I don't know how often," said Eleanor, "but it must happen very frequently. Whenever I want you to take me with you anywhere in your car, I am always told that there is something wrong with it, or else that the chauffeur has got neuralgia and you don't like to ask him to go out." "He suffers quite a lot from neuralgia," said Mrs. Attray hastily. "Anyhow," she continued, "you can understand that I don't want to offend the Nordrums. Their household is the most rackety one in the country, and I believe no one even knows to an hour or two when any particular meal will appear on the table, or what it will consist of when it does appear." Eleanor Saxby shuddered. She liked her meals to be of regular occurrence and assured proportions. "Still," pursued Mrs. Attray, "whatever their own home life may be, as landlords and neighbors, they are considerate and obliging, so I don't want to quarrel with them. Besides, if Ronnie didn't play cards there, he'd be playing somewhere else." "Not if you were firm with him," said Eleanor. "I believe in being firm." "Firm? I am firm," exclaimed Mrs. Attray. "I'm more than firm. I am far-seeing. I've done everything I can think of to prevent Ronnie from playing for money. I've stopped his allowance for the rest of the year so he can't even gamble on credit, and I've subscribed a lump sum to the church offertory in his name instead of giving him installments of small silver to put in the bag on Sundays. I wouldn't even let him have the money to tip the hunt servants with, but sent it by postal order. He was furiously sulky about it, but I reminded him of what happened to the 10 shillings that I gave him for the Young Men's Endeavor League. Self-denial week. What did happen to it? Well, Ronnie did some preliminary endeavoring with it on his own account in connection with the Grand National, I suppose the horse race. If it had come off, as he expressed it, he would have given the league 25 shillings and netted a comfortable commission for himself. As it was, the 10 shillings was one of the things the league had to deny itself. Since then, I've been careful not to let him have a penny piece in his hands. He'll get round that in some way, said Eleanor with a quiet conviction. He'll sell things. My dear, he's done all that is to be done in that direction already. He's got rid of his wristwatch and his hunting flask and both cigarette cases, and I shouldn't be surprised if he's wearing imitation gold sleeve links instead of those his Aunt Rhoda gave him on his 17th birthday. He can't sell all his clothes, of course, except his winter. He can't sell his clothes, of course, except his winter overcoat, and I've locked that up in the camphor cupboard on the pretext of preserving it from moth. I really don't see what else he can raise money on. I consider that I've been both firm and far-seeing. Has he been at the Nordrums lately? Asked Eleanor. He was there yesterday afternoon and stayed to dinner, said Mrs. Attray. I don't quite know when he came home, but I fancy it was late. Then depend on it, he was gambling, said Eleanor with the assured air of one who has few ideas and makes the most of them. Late hours in the country always mean gambling. He can't gamble if he has no money and no chance of getting any, argued Mrs. Attray. Even if one plays for small stakes, one must have a decent prospect of paying one's losses. He may have sold some of the Amherst pheasant chicks, suggested Eleanor. They would fetch about 10 or 12 shillings each, I dare say. Ronnie wouldn't do such a thing, said Mrs. Attray, and anyhow, I went and counted them this morning, and they're all there. No, she continued with the quiet satisfaction that comes from a sense of painstaking and merited achievement. I fancy that Ronnie had to connect himself with the role of onlooker last night as far as the card table is concerned. Is that clock right? Asked Eleanor, whose eyes had been straying restlessly toward the mantelpiece for some little time. Lunch is usually so punctual in your establishment. 3 minutes past the half hour, exclaimed Mrs. Attray. Cook must be preparing something unusually sumptuous in your honor. I'm not in on the secret. I've been out all the morning, you know. Eleanor smiled forgivingly. A special effort by Mrs. Attray's cook was worth waiting a few minutes for. As a matter of fact, the luncheon fare, when it made its tardy appearance, was distinctly unworthy of the reputation which the justly treasured cook had built up for herself. The soup alone would have sufficed to cast a gloom over any meal that it had inaugurated, and it was not redeemed by anything that followed. Eleanor said little, but when she spoke, there was a hint of tears in her voice that was far more eloquent than outspoken denunciation would have been, and even the insouciant Ronald showed traces of depression when he tasted the Rognone Saltykov. And maybe you listening will have some idea what dish that is, because I certainly do not. Rognone Saltykov, R-O-G-N-O-N-S, new word, capital S, salt, I-K-O-F-F. Not quite the best luncheon I've enjoyed in your house, said Eleanor at last, when her final hope had flickered out with the savory. My dear, it's the worst meal I've sat down to for years, said her hostess. That last dish tasted principally of red pepper and wet toast. I'm awfully sorry. Is anything the matter in the kitchen, Pellin? She asked of the attendant maid. Well, ma'am, the new cook had hardly time to see things properly, coming in so sudden, commenced Pellin by way of explanation. The new cook! Screamed Mrs. Attray. Colonel Nordrum's cook, ma'am, said Pellin. What on earth do you mean? What is Colonel Nordrum's cook doing in my kitchen, and where's my cook? Perhaps I can explain that better than Pellin can, said Ronald hurriedly. The fact is, I was dining at the Nordrums yesterday, and they were wishing they had a swell cook like yours, just for today and tomorrow. While they got some gourmet staying with them, their own cook is no earthly good. Well, you've seen what she turns out when she's at all flurried. So I thought it would be rather sporting to play them at baccarat for the loan of our cook against a money stake. And I lost, that's all. I have had rotten luck at baccarat all this year. The remainder of his explanation of how he had assured the cooks that the temporary transfer of his mother's sanction and had smuggled the one out and the other in during the maternal absence was drowned in the outcry of scandalized upbraiding. "If I had sold the woman into slavery, there couldn't have been a bigger fuss about it," he confided afterwards to Bertie Nordrum, "and Eleanor Saxelby raged and ramped the louder of the two. I'll tell you what, I'll bet you two of the Amherst pheasants to 5 shillings that she refuses to have me as a partner at the croquet tournament. We're drawn together, you know." This time, he won his bet. And that was the stake about the betting by Ronald Attray, Attray. Anyway, that will do it for the 4 stories today from Saki. And as I say, you can find everything we recorded, vnnforum.com. And thanks for being with me, and I will be back with you again real soon.